Hi, I'm Michael, and welcome to Beyond the Screenplay, the podcast where each week we do a conversational deep dive analysis into a film. Except for this week, when we are going through and talking about our favorite films of the 1980s. To be more precise, some of us are going to talk about our favorite films from the 1980s, and some of us are going to list the 10 films that they've seen from the 1980s. Longtime listeners, you can decide who's who. I'm joined by the Beyond the Screenplay team, Trisha Rand.
Hello, everyone.
Brian Bittner.
Take a chill pill, Wastoid.
And Alex Gallegos.
And that's why Michael hates the 80s.
And scene.
Okay, so let's talk about how we do our top 10 rundowns. So we're going to go in order. So the order is going to be Alex, then Trisha, then Michael, then Brian. And we're going to start by listing our number 10s through number 4s. So Alex is going to list 10 through 4 of his favorite films of the 80s. Then we're going to pause, talk about it, and then move on through the list as such. After we've done that, then we're going to go around, going to do maybe a quick intermission, talk about the 80s in general, if we're feeling motivated to, inspired perhaps. And then we're going to go around in that same order, Alex, Trisha, Michael, Brian, talk about our number 3 favorite films, boom, boom, boom. Then our number 2 favorite films, boom, boom, boom. And then ending with our number 1 favorite films of the 1980s. Are you guys ready to begin?
Yes.
Audacious.
Excellent. I feel like I'm hosting a game show. There's not like a whole lot of game to it, but like...
Wow.
I mean, the reveal of the order, I am very curious about. Mm-hmm. Even if there's overlap between us, I'm very curious about the order.
Now that you mention a game show, though, it does feel like there should be a way to win.
Oh.
Like, could one of us win?
Interesting.
I don't know how or what the criteria would be. But
listeners can tell us who had the best list.
There we go.
There you go. The people will decide who won.
Yeah.
But if I come up with rules along the way... I'll share them. An improvised game could be fun. Okay. All right. So, let's dive in. Let's begin. Alex, what are your number 10 through number 4 favorite films of the 1980s?
All right. So, yeah, like we've always said with these lists, it's a really hard question of are these the best films or are these the films that I have watched the most and therefore know the most and care about the most? And with the 80s, especially, that is my list. It's just the movies that I happen to have seen a lot and care about. So with that as a warning, here is my list, top 10 of the 1980s. So for number 10, because I haven't seen it for a while, I'm lumping two films together. I'm lumping The Breakfast Club and 16 Candles together because I remember loving 16 Candles. I have not watched it since I was actually in high school, like a teenager. And then watching Breakfast Club recently reminded me of how much I love 16 Candles. And so I'm going to like say that's a thing that I like from the 80s in combo right there, because I cannot say with authority which one I like better at this moment.
Cheating right out the gate.
Well, I just haven't had time. I have that time to revisit it. So that's my number 10. Number 9, The Little Mermaid. Aww. Number 8, Back to the Future. Number 7, Blue Velvet. Number 6, Blade Runner. Number 5, Empire Strikes Back. And number 4, Return of the Jedi.
Yeah.
All right.
Nice. Okay.
I decided to be honest with those last two in their order.
Yeah, provocative, daring choice. Interesting. Okay, yeah. So I think there will be some overlap coming up. But Blue Velvet, interesting. Tell me about Blue Velvet. Why that movie?
Yeah, you know, I'm not somebody who automatically loves everything David Lynch does, but two of his films, Blue Velvet and Mulholland Drive, which was on another of my top 10 lists, are the two films of his that have kind of influenced me and resonate with me and just hit this perfect, weird, almost satirical darkness. They're both films that I laugh a lot while watching and are also both deeply disturbing and just really just there's a kind of like a weird wicked joy to watch for me. And the Blue Velvet is, you know, one half of that David Lynch thing that I love. So yeah, that's why it ranks relatively high on my list, because I do think it has influenced me like as an adult filmmaker and some kind of dark sensibilities within myself, I think, resonate with Blue Velvet.
I really like the phrase wicked joy.
Yeah, yeah.
So far, the best thing to come out of this episode.
And, you know, The Little Mermaid is on this list, not
just like Blue Velvet.
Just like, yeah, on the opposite end of the spectrum. Whereas Blue Velvet was kind of something I watched later in life and influenced me, kind of like post-film school filmmaker me. The Little Mermaid is like, I talk about Jurassic Park often as being the origin of wanting to be a filmmaker, but Little Mermaid really is the origin. That's like the first feature film I remember seeing of any sort, you know, probably on VHS tape at home as a 3-year-old or something, a very, very young child. And, you know, probably some of my love for the ocean comes from that movie and just the magic of that, like, beginning of the Disney Renaissance. That defines so much of who I am. Those films as part of my childhood. So that had to be on the list because, Disney movies are probably half the reason I'm here, along with the Spielberg side of the equation.
Nice. Cool. Okay. All right, cool. All right, well, we're off to a good start. Trisha, we're going over to you now. Tell me about your top 10 through top 4 favorite films of the 1980s.
Yeah, so I did manage to do this. For me, it's always definite whittling down of a list. I want to maybe put a pin in this, or we can talk about it after we get through everybody's top 10s kind of thing, or 10 through 4s. But the thing about the 80s is there are these towering cultural landmarks. And, you know, a few of them are going to hit a bingo, I think, for all of us. I don't know. In making this list, I sort of had this look in the mirror moment of how much do these mean to me personally?
Yeah.
It's like going to visit an actual physical landmark, you know, in the United States or something, and just being but how much does the Statue of Liberty mean to me personally? I get it. It's pretty important. It's important. But how much does this actually is it unique to sort of me? I ran into this with some of these Star Wars and some of these other huge properties. And I think I came to the conclusion that they do mean something to me personally, but also just because you can't take them out of cinema history. And so you can't unmake their influence on anything, including yourself. But at the same time, it's are these really my actual favorites in my, the tiniest Russian doll box at the center of my heart when I really get in there. So anyway, just want to say that that's a thing that happened when I was making this list. I did some soul searching about that. That being said, for a while, I want to say Last Crusade was actually in my top 10, and it's not right now, even though I really do love that movie. When Harry Met Sally is not in my top 10 right now. I have it ranked at 15, and I adore that movie, but there's all these other things that you have to say because you have to say them. They're, you know, mountains or whatever. I don't know. What are our goddamn landmarks?
Landmarks. Okay, so we have three landmarks of these movies that aren't in your top 10.
But let's get into it anyway. So number 10 is Empire Strikes Back. And it's a lot farther back than I originally had it. But then I realized it doesn't belong any higher than that for me personally. But Die Hard is number 9. Dead Poets Society is number 8. The Breakfast Club is number 7. Little Mermaid is number 6. So I see you, Alex. Back to the Future is number 5. And The Princess Bride is number 4.
Nice. Okay. Some ones that are jumping out at me. Dead Poets Society. Talk to me about that movie.
Oh, Captain, My Captain.
That movie was very influential on me in high school, in middle and high school, which is probably about when I saw it. And I could get into it, you know, it's just it's so much to unpack. It's such an interesting screenplay. It's maybe the greatest example of the inspirational teacher film, but it's also about literature, right? It's about words and the influence that words can have on people, and especially young people, and what it means to be a writer in particular. And so I think it was very impactful for me for that reason. And, you know, also is about challenging yourself and making bold choices and seizing the day and all of those things. I do still really love it is the thing. Like I've showed it to teenagers since, you know, that time, and modern teenagers. And actually,
you carpe'd into their DMs.
Hey. No.
Sorry, I just have to high five myself for that.
Wow.
Ryan. Wow. Wow. I'm just saying it when it hits you in adolescence, because that really is, you know, it's a movie about that and looking at yourself and who you want to be and making a bold choice about who that is. I think that there's still something there at the heart of that movie that's really beautiful. Not the least of which is Robin Williams' performance and some of the other performances in it, which are super gorgeous. So yeah, I'm going to stand by that one.
And Princess Bride is pretty high up there, number 4.
Yeah. I'm not going to apologize. That movie rules.
No apologies. I just want to hear about your relationship with it.
Well, it's one of my dad's favorite movies. I feel like I get into that a lot because a lot of my favorite movies are inherited from my dad. And we had it on VHS growing up. We watched it a gazillion times. But it's also like it's archetypal while messing with archetypes. We've talked about that. Some of the best examples of a genre movie are parodies or like self-aware of being in that genre. We're about to talk about some Indiana Joneses, I would wager. And those are some of the best adventure movies around, and they're supposed to be kind of parodies of adventure movies, but they're leading into genre convention in a way that's really effective and exciting. And The Princess Bride does exactly that. Like, it's leaning into genre convention, swashbuckling, big, sprawling fantasy action adventure thing. And it's entertaining on that level, as well as being smart and savvy and self-aware. And Michael hates it, so you guys can tweet at him about that.
Hate is not the right word. It's also not the wrong word, but it's not the word that I would choose.
Well, yeah, that's the one I chose for you.
Yeah, you're welcome. That's fair. Again, my first touch point with that story was my high school class putting it on as a play. And so I was like behind the scenes of people doing The Princess Bride as a play. And I feel like
that'd be tough.
It was just so
weird.
That'd be tough.
A little inconceivable.
Yeah. Anyway. Cool. Well, so to keep things moving.
Your turn.
My turn.
Yeah. Okay.
So I'll read the list and then I'll talk about it. Okay. So number 10, Rain Man. Number 9, Raiders of the Lost Ark. Number 8, Return of the Jedi. Number 7, The Shining. Number 6, Blade Runner. Number 5, The Breakfast Club. And number 4, Back to the Future.
Whoa. Nice. Late edition, high ranking Breakfast Club.
Right?
Damn. Like,
there was a moment where it was in my top 3. And I don't know. Making this list has been weird because there are movies, like you were saying, Alex, like we've all been saying, that I grew up with watching over and over again. Back to the Future being one where it's like, that used to be all I would watch. I would watch Star Wars and then I'd take a break to watch Back to the Future so that I could take a break to watch Star Wars. Like, that was just, so there's those kinds of movies. There's movies that I later came to appreciate, like Blade Runner, that I appreciate as a film and as an experience and, like, you know, all of that and the artsy side of things. And it's the Indiana Joneses and the Star Wars. But there's also movies that I haven't seen in a long time that I think I still really like. And like Rain Man falls into that category where I remember watching it and I remember being blown away by it and being really emotional. But I haven't seen it in a really long time. So I'm kind of like, I hope I still feel this way about it. And that's why it's kind of hovering there.
But I mean, it's definitely a good movie.
definitely a good movie. Yeah, but yeah, Breakfast Club was really good. I'm glad I saw it. It's high.
We went
up there
from like, what if we made Michael watch Breakfast Club one day, to wow, Michael watched Breakfast Club and kind of liked it, to it's in his top 10.
Michael's life.
Yeah. Top 5 of the 80s.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, that's my list. I don't know.
Well, that's and when it comes to Breakfast Club, Michael, what did catapult it up to number 5 over some of those other classics that you have in 6 through 10? How did you come to that equation?
I think part of it, you know, in like our top films of the 90s, one of the criteria we set often was like, what movie would I want to go watch right now? And The Breakfast Club, I've only seen twice basically at this point. And so as opposed to all the other movies on this, I'm more like willing to go watch that one again. I don't need to watch Back to the Future again right now.
Oh, I do.
But I want to. Yes. Yeah. More like Blade Runner. I don't know that I need to sit down and watch every single thing. Yeah. But also, yeah, it's just as we talked about in our episode about it, it's just really good storytelling. There's a lot of truth and honesty about like being a human and growing up and adolescence and all that stuff that like, I don't know, I was personally touched by it and very impressed by the filmmaking and the performances and just really good movie. So, yeah.
Nice. Okay.
All right, Brian,
oh boy.
Take us 10 through 4.
All right. So, yeah, this was hard. This was like the 90s for me where it was like the battle of the number 10s for me, where I was just like, what would I feel the least bad about, you know, not being on the list? And Alex, you're making me feel bad because Blue Velvet was there.
Brian.
I know.
And my fellow Lynchian. What are you doing?
It's like the first decade where you have a Lynch and I don't.
Shocking.
But it's definitely my number 11. So getting into the list, my number 10, the one I just couldn't bump was Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. Number 9 is Say Anything. Number 8 is Weekend at Bernie's. Number 7 is The Princess Bride. Number 6 is The Shining. Number 5 is Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom.
Wow.
And number 4 is Star Wars Episode 6, Return of the Jedi.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think we know why Temple of Doom is up there, because we've talked about, you know, the Indiana Jones films. But for people that maybe haven't listened to that episode, explain yourself.
I mean, so much. I don't know if we've really done like our like movie loving origin story. Maybe we did it on a Q&A or some point. But I think at some point my mom just like bought me a stack of VHSs from the bargain bin at A to Z Video down the street from our house or whatever. And it was like a movie that I will save for my number one to talk about, and Weekend at Bernie's and Temple of Doom and Return of the Jedi, this 1991 movie called Time Trackers that's only available on YouTube these days. and Kirk Cameron and Dudley Moore and Like Father, Like Son. It was just these like this weird smattering of movies that I got, and I would just watch them all the time because those were the movies I had. And yeah, so weirdly, it's like Return of the Jedi and Temple of Doom are just these like the movies that I love from those trilogies because I grew up with them and watched them more than the others, even though they're the ones people are like, wait, but that's the bad one. What are you talking about? So yeah, they just have a very special place in my heart. And honestly, watching Temple of Doom again recently, when we talked about, you know, the Indiana Jones, I was just like, I'm having so much fun. Like this, the first like 20 minutes of that movie is just like such a good time. Is it a great movie? No. Is it the best Indiana Jones movie? Absolutely not. Is it the worst of the first three? Yes. But do I just love it dearly? Absolutely.
Wow. And that's great. That's what this is all about.
Yeah, and I'm almost hesitant to give you a platform, but Weekend at Bernie's.
I mean, again, it was that stack. It was, I can remember, like, that's a movie where I don't know when the last time I actually watched it was, but I could tell you what the music, I could tell you what the trailers were on the VHS beforehand. I could tell you what the music is that opens the movie. I could tell you like what the first lines of, it was just, I watched that movie all the time. There were movies I rented, like Weird Science, I think we rented, and like I watched it probably 10 times.
That movie's great.
3 days we had it or something, you know. But the movies that I actually had like access to all the time, like Return of the Jedi, like Temple of Doom, like Weekend at Bernie's, I watched them so much. And Weekend at Bernie's just holds such a special place in my heart.
It's the power of the random VHS tapes our parents happen to have in the collection.
Wrong.
Yeah. Like, shaped our lives.
And it along with Say Anything are the only movies on my list that are that don't have any magic or ghosts or sci-fi or robots in them.
Those things were popular in the 80s.
Yeah.
Yep.
Wouldn't it be nice to have a curated selection of unique films from around the world, hand-selected by expert curators who are passionate about elevating great cinema? Luckily, exactly what I'm describing exists, and it's called Mubi. Mubi is a streaming service where each and every film is hand-selected. From iconic directors to emerging auteurs, there's always something new to discover. For example, right now Mubi is streaming Melancholia, the stunning and thought-provoking film by acclaimed director Lars von Trier. With a free 30-day trial, you can experience Mubi's library of films for yourself. And by signing up, you're also supporting Beyond the Screenplay and helping us to continue to make new episodes. So why not try Mubi for free today? Just visit mubi.com/beyondthescreenplay to start your free trial and discover a world of great cinema. That's mubi.com/beyondthescreenplay. Thank you to Mubi for sponsoring Beyond the Screenplay. Okay, that's cool. Well, and yeah, it's making me wonder, like, kids these days, if they don't have the VHS tapes that are lying around, what do they, are they like, oh yeah, I love that stupid Google ad in front of that YouTube video that I watched all the time. Right. Like, what is their nostalgic thing?
As we've been talking, I just feel so old, because like the experience we're describing is like of ye old past times. Like, this is not a thing anymore. So this is like,
listen, none of you ragamuffins actually lived through the majority of the 80s. So if anyone feels old here.
Well, and so I think that's, yeah, that's an interesting thing about, you know, as we've moved backwards through these decades of like contemporary films and then getting to like the 90s, where a lot of us, well, I mean, all of us were children and growing up in the 90s, the 80s, you know, I was four when the 80s ended. And so really any movies that I like remember and appreciate, I would have had to seen, you know, after they came out. Right. So it's like there's a certain amount of, if you're born at a certain time, movies around the time that you were, you know, a child and before, you have to seek out to appreciate. And it is interesting. We're talking off mic a little bit about this, but Alex, you brought up the point of like, you know, at some point, if you're a film person, there is sort of a like the laundry list of these are the best films that have ever been made. And you have to watch this despite like whether they're from your era or not. And yeah, there was a, there was an idea posited that like there was more of those from the 70s than the 80s. And I wonder if that's true.
Yeah, that's my sense, but maybe not. You know, why are the 80s this not great period for Michael and I in particular in our kind of like film catalog of films that we've seen and know well? And I think there's a lot of films from the preceding decades, from the 70s and a little bit in the 60s, where there's a lot of these very classic must-see, must-watch in film school movies. And I can't think of a whole lot of those from the 80s. And so if you weren't a conscious, you know, child old enough to like watch and register movies in the 80s, you do have to like seek those movies out, and you're not probably going to be forced to seek them out in a film school or like film buff context as much as some films from earlier eras, is my feeling. What do you guys think?
I mean, I think it's safe to say, you know, Alien came out in the 70s, Aliens came out in the 80s, The Godfather came out in the 70s, Scarface came out in the 80s,
right?
You know, like there is this sort of, in the 70s, people were making these very like gritty kind of filmy films. And in the 80s, there was a bit more of a sense of fun. There was like, let's put lot musical numbers into our movies. I mean, not that there weren't musical numbers in like the, you know, the, obviously the 60s and the 70s, but like just this sort of sense of like style and fun and kind of whimsy and that kind of thing. And it just has a different feel to it than the 70s do. And that sort of became the thing of the 80s that bled into the early 90s, was just this like, look at everything, look at all these colors, look at all this stuff, you know? And that doesn't mean there aren't like amazing, great films from the 80s. It's just like those, it's part of why I think those decades just have a different flavor to them.
Well, and without getting into like a history lesson that we don't need to get into, you know, the 70s were very reactionary in like a positive way of like people grappling with these like huge world issues and also like starting to have the freedom to make these, you know, sort of grimy, edgier films about, you know, kind of real life and like how difficult things are. And so is filmmakers that were getting a chance to kind of like dive into stuff for the first time in like mainstream cinema. And then in the 80s, there was almost this weariness to that. So there's some degree of like people trying to imitate some of the big successes of the 70s. So that's why you're starting to see the sequels, the Star Wars sequels coming out. And some of these like big budget, like, you know, four quadrant, you know, kind of Indiana Jonesy kind of things. That's that kind of like getting into the blockbuster mentality that was really kind of created in the 70s, but really, you know, found its footing in the late 70s. And so we're kind of seeing the blockbuster era here. And, you know, Back to the Future is also a big part of this, where it's like, we're going to have fun. We're going to make these big popcorn movies. We're going to actually like bust some blocks here. But then also you have an economic recession that hit in the early 1980s, and people started going, they went to the movies to have fun. They didn't want to deal with like the grime and the grit and the Vietnam War anymore. Like they were just, they got tired of that kind of thing. And so these genre films, so we've gotten, you know, we kind of getting into some of the rom-coms and some of the teen movies and stuff like that. That's what arises out of like, a film-going audience that is in a recession that wants to escape and go to the movies for that reason. And so you kind of see that in culture more broadly. And the studio system also was kind of figuring out what it was going to be in the, you know, after the new Hollywood filmmaker guys and really, you know, started that movement in the 70s. You kind of have these film school guys in the 80s that are kind of coming up and into their own and starting to make movies in a different way, having learned from these 60s and 70s directors, but kind of, yeah, using technology in a lot of ways to sort of forge new ground. And that's kind of what leads into the 90s era. So there's lots going on here, but not all of it necessarily makes for like a perfect cocktail of cinema masterpiece. They were trying stuff is what I mean. They were throwing a lot of spaghetti at the wall in the 1980s.
And some of the spaghetti is amazing and beautiful and like are cornerstones of our like film history. So like not to diminish the 80s, because like they're, you know, Empire Strikes Back is the 80s. You know, like Blade Runner is the 80s. So I mean, there's a lot that happened in the 80s that is pivotal in our kind of film consciousness. But yeah, for some reason, it does feel like, I feel like I've studied more 70s movies than 80s movies for the reasons I think you've laid out, Trisha, of just there are more serious films.
They're the high art.
Yeah, from the preceding decade.
The 80s are usually not considered to be that.
Yeah,
it's interesting. I was just on the IMDb top 250 counting, and I think there's about like 25 movies on there from the 80s, and I think only like 30, 35 maybe from the 90s. So it's not a crazy, you know, difference there. Not that the IMDb top 250 is a scientific, you know, list of all the things, but yeah, it's interesting. There's also, VHS tapes and the rise of like the
home media,
all these like technical things and cultural things, as you're saying, the ebbs and flows of all these things is really interesting to track over time.
Yeah. And I think that's where, you know, just this idea of nostalgia comes into play too. It's like, you know, for me, it's not just, I saw this movie when I was a kid and loved it. It's, I watched this movie 50 times when I was a kid, you know? And so it's like, and I was also just like a pop culture junkie as a kid. I was listening to the music and watching the shows and watching MTV and playing video games and all this stuff. So it's like, for me, I can definitely watch an 80s movie and go, God, this is so 80s. It's obnoxious. And I kind of hate it a little bit, but I have a pretty high tolerance for a lot of that stuff. Whereas for other people, and maybe Michael, this includes you, it's like, if you didn't grow up watching a lot of that kind of style of thing, whether it was movies or television or even I don't know, a commercial or something, like, right, like watch commercials from the 80s or the early 90s and you're like, what the hell is going on? Which I'm sure they'll be saying about commercials from today, because whenever I watch live TV all by accident,
that's,
I'm like,
what I say
happening
about them right now. Yeah. What are commercials?
But I think that's an interesting thing too, is like, it's not just how you grew up, it, like what you grew up on affects your nostalgia for a thing or whatever. It also, it sort of affects like what kinds of stuff you just have tolerance for, or you have an affinity for, or you have a distaste for, or whatever. So I think that's an interesting part of this conversation too. And the 80s is like the the pinnacle of this conversation.
And I think there's an extent to which we as film people, critics, analysts, who are we? Podcasters in this case. Sometimes there's an automatic assumption that like, yeah, you absolutely have to have seen these 300 movies. And they span every decade and they have this and, you know, they come from every country and they come from everywhere. And I think overall, taking in, you know, as much as you can or have a preference for it makes sense. But also, as a film just going person, it is okay to have taste. And it is okay to, like, abstain from things that are not to your taste. You know, maybe don't loudly shout your opinion if you haven't seen a lot of a particular genre, you know, or from a particular decade. Like, I'm not here to loudly shout my opinion about horror movies because I haven't seen that many, like, or whatever, you know, whatever your the particular thing that's not to your taste is. I'm not going to be a horror movie podcaster. So there's a humility that has to go into that. But just acknowledging that we're also people with limited amounts of time to spend on what we take in. And so I think, yeah, having a basic working knowledge of film history includes seeing things from every era, but it doesn't necessarily mean seeing everything from every era. That's not reasonable.
Hmm. Yeah. And do it all thoughtfully. Like,
of course.
Like, if you don't like something, like you said, don't go around dragging people's attention and being like, hey, I want to tell you about how I don't like this thing you like. but also, like, investigate why.
Sure.
Because there's useful information in that as you are developing your taste and your palate and the things that you like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I just want to add, like, it's also really lovely to, you know, do this with you guys, you know, and by you guys, I mean the three of you, but also everyone listening, where it's like we get to just kind of watch some stuff together, you know, and talk about it. Like, it made me so happy that you guys watched Rocky for the first time and loved it. Like, I was in Breakfast Club too, right? And it's just, and I got to either see movies like The Mummy or, you know, something that you guys were introducing me to.
You got to see it.
Right. Yes. Or just revisit a movie like Little Miss Sunshine and be like, oh yeah, like I liked it fine the first time. But then when I'm watching it again kind of years later, or like with a critical eye, I'm going like, oh yeah, this is really good. It's that sort of thing you would do when you were 19. Be like, oh, you haven't seen such and such? We're watching it right now, you know, and you can't. We can't do that quite as much as adults as we could back then, but we can do it in podcast form.
Yeah. Thanks, indeed. Listeners.
Yeah. And to be clear, you could still make fun of Michael, though, for having not seen very many 80s movies.
Correct.
Knock yourself out.
Yeah.
All right. Well, so speaking of 80s movies, let's move to our top threes here. I was looking at it, and I feel like the chance of bingo is actually lower than I was expecting. There's a lot of things covered up right now. I think the only one that maybe has a shot is Back to the Future, maybe Empire. I got my eyes on a couple of things, but we're going to see starting right now. Alex, what is your number three favorite film of the 1980s?
My number three is The Shining, which nice. I think, Michael, you also had as, was it number seven, six?
Seven, yeah.
Number seven, yeah.
Number six for me.
Right.
Yeah, and yeah, The Shining, I mean, yeah, it's The Shining. it's great. Anyway, it's fun. Like, I think what is interesting about Kubrick as a director is that he does dip his toes into so many different genres, but he does them in his Kubricky way. And it's almost like part of what I think is interesting about Kubrick is he kind of goes towards the essence of things and including within a genre. And so you can feel like with 2001: A Space Odyssey, I think he said on record that he wants to make, you know, the ultimate science fiction movie, or get at, like, you know, like science fiction, and not just these like campy 60s things, but like something pure about science fiction. And I feel that purity in The Shining, where it's, you know, what is the purpose of a horror movie or a psychological thriller? What is at the essence of it? And I feel that essence in The Shining. And so, yeah, of kind of classic horror movies, it's always my favorite because of that purity in just the vibes, the dread vibes it gives.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of dread vibes. I was like hesitant to even put it on my list because I was like, I hate watching this movie because it's terrifying, but it's so good. Yeah, it's very effective. Cool. Okay. So Alex's number three is The Shining. Trisha, what is your number three favorite film of the 1980s?
My number three is Raising Arizona.
Yeah.
I've talked about the Coens a lot. I adore them. I think it's one of their best comedies. I think it's so funny. Like, I don't know. I've seen it so many times. This is another thing I inherited from my dad, is this movie in particular. Like, my dad doesn't love all the Coens the way that I do, but he really loves their comedies, and he really loves this one. I just think it's great. Like, I don't know. All the performances are great. It's so goofy and wacky. Nicolas Cage, Holly Hunter, like, I love it. They steal a baby. I mean, like, it's, and then like the angel of death is like riding around behind them on a motorcycle and like everything. Oh, it's so good. I love this movie. It's got some of the best like sequences in it, I think, of like any Coen movie. The sequence where he robs the convenience store for the diapers is, Michael's just staring at me. There's no chance he's seen this.
Seen parts of it.
It's just like perfection, just cinematic perfection. And I, you know, it's that classic madcap crime comedy that the Coens do so well. For me, it's like the prototypical like madcap crime comedy from a Coen, for the Coen brothers. And it's one of the ones where like it doesn't get really violent and gruesome ever. Like, there's something really fun and pure spirited about it. It's just, it's the best. I love it. Raising Arizona.
There's no wood chopper. Yeah.
No, there's no wood. Yeah. There's no wood chippers in it.
Yeah.
There's no like cattle murdering device. Like, yeah. No, it's great.
I just realized that I've seen parts of it is a euphemism, can be a euphemism for, I started watching it and then stopped.
Can't be, not in this case.
I love that the Coen brothers are getting some love because I was thinking about Blood Simple.
And I wondered if you would.
Yeah. I mean, I'd seen it years ago, but just rewatching it a couple of years ago, I just fell so hard in love with it. But I was like, but it can't be my top 10 when I sort of just rediscovered it. Although Breakfast Club and Michael, I guess it can be, but yeah, it wasn't for me. But I'm glad that the Coens are showing up here.
Oh, hell yeah.
Yeah. Thanks.
Michael.
Okay. Yeah, so my number three is Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade.
There you go.
Nice.
Hell yeah.
It's really good, like we've talked about, and I think it hit at that age where it formed for me, like, this is what a movie is, and this is what I want a movie to be. It's like, it's got action, but it's got character. It's got, like, kind of a twisty femme fatale romance, but there's father-son stuff, and there's, like, airplane. Like, it's just, it has all the adventure. It has all the heart. It has all the things that you know, young Michael wants from a movie, a blockbuster. So, yeah, we've talked about it a lot. All those reasons. Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade.
Never I was very one. Surprised that I didn't make Trisha's list.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. That was a blow. I'm not going to lie.
I know. I'm so sorry, guys. It's really, really, really good, but I just...
To understand.
10 is not very many movies, okay? Yeah,
I know.
You're allowed yes. to not have it in your list.
Thank you. Yes.
We forgive you.
Yeah. But will we forgive Brian's number three of the 1980s?
Which is Star Wars Episode 5, The Empire Strikes Back. Pretty,
yeah, we'll probably forgive that.
Yeah.
Pretty safe one, yeah. Yeah, despite, you know, what I said about Temple of Doom, where it's like, well, I grew up with it, so of course it's my favorite. It's like, I grew up with all the Star Wars, but Return of the Jedi was the only one that I know I had. When you watch something a lot, and I've definitely seen the Star Wars is more than I've seen the Indiana Joneses, although it's pretty close. When you see something a lot, the nostalgia is not as important as just how good do you think it is today, you know? And I think that as much as I will always love Return of the Jedi. I love it so much, but it's like whenever I have to rank them, because this is what we do in nerddom. I'm always like, but Empire's so good. Like, it's just, I'm just like always so impressed by how it is. And it's sort of weird. Like, it's structurally weird. And it, you know, and it like, there's something about it that just makes me go, man, you can make a blockbuster sort of fantasy, you know, thing that is also really challenging and ends on a sour note. And you can like, you can do that stuff. So they're really neck and neck, but Empire just ekes out Return of the Jedi if I really have to put them next to each other.
Nice.
Yeah. And see, for me, you're absolutely right about all of that, but there's something about Return of the Jedi and the sticking the landing of the Vader Luke, just like pathos, yeah, and just like the like better than ever space battle that set a standard for me as like a young person of just like, wow, you can like end something like really well and like end it like big and perfectly emotionally. And I, you know, Ewoks were great, you know, as a kid. And so Return of the Jedi, you know, even though it, by so many metrics, it is not as good a movie as Empire Strikes Back, forever for me is like the first example of a trilogy sticking the landing in a way that I think, you know, Return of the King also did for me, which is why I also love Return of the King in the Lord of the Rings franchise.
Yeah. And Star Wars would go on to continue to stick the landings of their trilogies.
I was going to say, like, on and
on. Always.
As we know. All right. We're on to our number twos. So, Alex, what is your number two film?
My number two film is Aliens. Because I am the inverse. I am the inverse of Michael. And I always loved Aliens more than Alien growing up. I was less classy and I love me some James Cameron. And yeah, just Aliens. I mean, it's just part of that, you know, pantheon of the Cameron thing, which is just epic genre movies with great protagonists, crystal clear stakes and emotions and character arcs, and just giving you your money's worth and more, always going the extra mile. You think you've gotten your climax, that's as good as it's going to be, and then there's even another climax, it's even bigger and better and more emotional. I watched Titanic recently. I saw it in 3D in theaters because it's been 25 years since it came out, apparently. And I, during the first, you know, 20 minutes, I was like, oh, did I really have to come see this again? Maybe I didn't have to come see this again. And by the end of the movie, I'm like, God damn it, James Cameron, like, you're so good. Like, yeah, like you did it all with this movie, and you did all of the things 100%, like love story 100%, disaster movie 100%, period piece 100%. And Aliens is one of those Cameron movies that just feels like everything is 100%. So yeah, that's why it's so high on my list.
Nice. Like, part of me wants to say that, like, everything you need to know about somebody is like, are you an alien person or an aliens person?
Right.
Which is better? Like,
it's like stones.
That's our yin and yang, Michael.
Yeah. Yeah.
Somebody asked me where my parents are.
Where are your parents?
They're dead. All right. Can I go now?
Yep. There it is.
Nice.
My name's Newt. Nobody calls me Rebecca. Except my brother.
Trisha, what is your number two favorite film of the 1980s?
My number two is Raiders of the Lost Ark. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there it is. And for the simple reason that I was thinking about this and Last Crusade, and, you know, it's the Marion Ravenwood of it all for me.
Yeah.
I mean, like, so many other things. Like, I was thinking about the action sequences in Raiders, and, like, they're so great, and, like, they never let up. It's such a thrill ride from start to finish. The pacing's incredible. It's so efficient. We've talked about it to death. Anyway, it rules. It's, like, a perfect action-adventure movie for my money. Like, it just is perfect, pretty much every frame of it. Many other people have said that, and I'm certainly not the first, but it's quite good. So anyway, Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Nice.
No musical numbers, zero.
Yeah. You're correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think we have our first bingo, and that my number two is Empire Strikes Back.
There you go.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, and everybody said all the things about Empire, but it's one of those movies, like you were saying, Brian, that I loved as a kid, not as much as a kid because it wasn't as fun, as the, like, it had less explosions than the other ones and less lightsabers. But it was still really fun. And then over time, I've come to really, really appreciate it and how sophisticated it is. As you were saying, Brian, it balances all these things. It ends on a sour note. It does something that very few other movies, especially in a franchise, like have been able to do. And so I love that it continues to be a point of aspiration for that all these years later. And it's Star Wars. So, yeah. Yeah. Okay. And Brian, what is your number two?
Number two is Blade Runner.
Hey,
nice. Yeah. Talked about it before, you know, when we talked about it, obviously, but it's just a movie that's crept up on me over the past few years. You know, it's interesting. So many of these movies are like, oh, I saw it as a kid and I loved it. And Blade Runner, I saw, I don't know, when I was 23 or something, but then it was like every time I watch it or listen to the score or think about it, I'm just like, man, I just want to like soak up that world and the aesthetic, and I just want to live there. And you know, I like the story, I like the characters, but it's just one of those movies where the mood is just such. I was listening to the score today and I was just like, man. And the score has the dialogue scenes too, and do you like our owl? It's artificial, you know, like all that. So it's just like, it's like the dialogue is now burned into my brain because I've listened to the score so much. So it's like each thing is just making, it's like supporting the other thing. So yeah, Blade Runner was just really hard to put anywhere lower on my list.
Yeah. Yeah. That's completely, I mean, it is like this weird movie where somebody went to make a movie and they used all the things that you use to make a movie, like cameras and actors and lighting. And somehow they created an immersive experience in a way that's, I don't know, special and unique. All right, everyone. It's come down to this. Our number one favorite film of the 1980s decade. Alex, what is your number one film of the 1980s?
My number one film of the 1980s is Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade.
Wow.
Nice. Which I wasn't expecting, but as I was making the list, I'm just like, what is the movie that from this decade that it was probably the most joy, that maybe inspired me the most as a young aspiring filmmaker. So yeah, I was a little surprised that this ended up as number one. I wasn't kind of expecting that when I sat down to make this list. But when I thought back about the movies in the 80s that really influenced me and stick with me, and I still just love dearly to this day, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade is at the top, because I think it's a quintessential Spielberg adventure movie, which as a young aspiring filmmaker was what I wanted to make. And this one, I think it's interesting hearing your description of Raiders, Trisha, because I think Raiders is on all the greatest film lists. It's always the one that's cited of the Indiana Jones trilogy as like the one. And for me, Last Crusade was always the one. And I think there was this added element of the father-son story and the way that pays off and the way that it plays into the final kind of like series of tests and challenges that always like did the full Spielberg package for me in a way that Raiders of the Lost Ark feels almost more like this interesting explosion of creativity and like Spielberg swinging for the fences and doing this kind of bold new thing. But I feel like I'm like in the hands of like the full Spielberg package with Last Crusade, and it always just gives me everything I want from Spielberg experience. So anyway, I feel like it is my Raiders, whereas Raiders is like the world's Indiana Jones movie. I've always felt Last Crusade is like the one, and I just love it so much. And also like the score, I think I mentioned it when we talked about this movie, but there are like John Williams themes in this movie beyond just the Indiana Jones theme that are, I think, are some of his most beautiful, simple themes. And I just love it's Spielberg, Williams, all of them at their peak. And I just love that era.
Yeah. I just remember when we watched, the trilogy, for the podcast, my partner and I, just after The Last Crusade, we just put kind of like took a beat and went, yeah, that's the best one. It's like, yeah, my favorite is going to be Temple of Doom for my own personal reasons, but just in terms of just what experience, like Raiders is maybe the best like film, right? And like maybe Temple of Doom is like entertaining in a lot of ways, but like Last Crusade just feels like it's sort of the perfect blend of everything to me.
I think that's neat about the Indiana Jones series is that like there's kind of one for everybody. Like,
it's true.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, yeah, I don't know. I think it's That's kind of what's cool and special about it. And there's a new one coming out soon.
Yeah. Crystal Skull is for somebody.
It is for someone.
Someone. Someone out there has that at the top of their list.
Angry alien.
God, I can't wait to, it's gonna be fun. All right. Trisha, what is your favorite movie of the 1980s?
Mine is E.T.
E.T.
We have an E.T. appearance. Nice.
Of course we do. Are you kidding me? Like, E.T. is just really special to me. It was a movie that I saw when I was really young. And I just really, I don't know. I just relate to it really hard. I think it's so beautiful. And, you know, it's about this lonely kid and he finds a friend. The storytelling in it is so fascinating and artful and gorgeous. There's like long stretches of it without dialogue. And then there's like plot events that are not explained or like barely explained in words. And there's something that's just so emotional about it where like the beats of the story feel a certain way without needing to have like structure, mechanical like perfection to them. So like, you know, the way that Elliot and E.T. like communicate and connect and all these things just feels like intuitive and like emotional and beautiful and magic in a way that transcends science fiction. This is why Michael hates E.T., among the many reasons. But
I mean, I think it's trauma why he hates it, because I also was a little traumatized by E.T. like when he's all pale and the evil like government's there. It's scary.
Yeah, my memory of it is a horror film, but yeah.
Well, and that's the thing is that I think there's something, if you watch it in childhood, that's why it's so special to so many people and why it's special to me. Because again, what it does in terms of like eschewing like sci-fi rules and world things speaks directly to the way that children experience narrative and stories and the way that we experience friendship and relationships and love and things and fear, like in all of these things. And so like there's this, I don't know, this just sort of lovely thematic soul at the heart of it that I will never get over. And like the bicycle theme, I think, is probably my favorite piece of music that John Williams has ever written. It was a ringtone on my phone for like a really long time. And
back when we did that.
Yeah. If like I could have written a movie and made a movie, I wish it would have been that one. I think it's like, that's one of my, if it couldn't have been Jurassic Park, I guess, but like, yeah, I just think it's gorgeous. And like, I'm never not going to cry at it and everything. So I think there's a reason why it doesn't hold up for a lot of people as they get older. And it's part of the reason probably that I'm talking about, but there is still so much like great filmmaking and like, yeah, a lot to analyze too. I think I pitched you a video about symbols in E.T., Michael, way back in the day. And it is one of the, again, because there are these long stretches that are kind of like dialogue-less, there's a lot of symbols and images doing work in that movie in a way that's so instructive and just like really, really beautiful. So
nice.
Yeah, that's awesome. I love E.T. It was released 2 weeks after I was. But I think, yeah, for me, it was like, it was a movie where I just haven't seen enough in the past 20 years or something, you know, but it's like, I remember loving it as a kid. And I know whenever I watch it, I love it, but it's like, I don't have that ongoing relationship with it. But coming off of Last Crusade, talking about movies that sort of do everything, it's like, you know, the 80s was this decade of just so much adventure, right? Whether it was sci-fi or fantasy or whatever. And wonder, yeah. So I was thinking about the movies that I saw a bunch as a kid, and it was like Neverending Story, which was really hard for me not to put on the list. Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, Little Mermaid, Harry and the Hendersons, Ghostbusters, Flight of the Navigator, Teen Wolf, even like Roger Rabbit. And then, you know, Indiana Jones and Star Wars and stuff. But it's like, I think E.T. is one of those examples of like, hey, you can do this, but also, you know, I mean, Steven Spielberg films are often, you can do this, but you can actually make a really good film out of it, you know, whether it's Jaws or Jurassic Park or E.T. And yeah, so I think E.T. is just like a, like what a quintessential example of this decade of like, you can do what the decade was, but you can also do it in a way that feels like a real film, if that makes sense.
We should watch it and talk about it.
I'm increasingly open to it.
There we go.
Hey.
After Breakfast Club, Michael's like, maybe this decade's...
The dam is broken.
Okay. Let's not get carried away, everybody. All right. I didn't say any of that. I said I'm increasingly open to watching this one movie.
All right. Well,
gotta keep my thing. All right. Without that, what's my identity? Yeah. Yes.
Think about your inner child, Michael, and the childlike wonder that film can inspire. No,
the trauma,
you.
The E.T. trauma.
Or the childlike trauma.
Right. Yeah. I feel like I was a different kid demons. Than other kids were.
All right, Michael, what's your number one?
My number one is When Harry Met Sally.
Oh, nice.
Wow.
Oh, so good.
It's just so good.
It is.
It's just so good. There's nothing more to say. It's just so
what do you have, a hot date?
Yeah, it's like it's fun to watch. It's charming. It's structurally interesting. There's clever writing. And it's just lightning in a bottle. And I don't know. It's just like everything. Just it's such a great like example of what I want like a romantic comedy to be, and not the like cookie cutter version that like was sort of like, you know, take pieces of it or try to replicate the surface of it. But like there's something deep character soul about love and friendship and what it means to like have a companion in the world that is captured in this while also being like hilarious. So yeah, it's one of my favorite films of all time. And so of course it's at the top of my 1980s list.
I think we just need to have a Carrie Fisher shout out on this episode.
Oh yeah. Yeah,
seriously.
Yeah.
Good job in the 80s.
The queen of everything.
Representing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, and to end us off here, to end us off.
To play us out?
To play us out.
What does that mean, to play us out?
There's no words here.
Cap it off.
Brian, what is your favorite film?
Appropriately enough, Sting was one of the choices for the lead in my favorite film, which is also my favorite film of all time, which is Labyrinth.
Whoa.
I did not think it would surprise anybody, but there you go.
I'm sorry. I know you like it, but you just said of all time.
Yep.
That's a okay qualifier. Go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a movie I watched a ton as a kid, so there's nostalgia there, obviously, but it's also a movie I've never gotten sick of, and I've appreciated in new ways over the years. There's just some interesting. There's like themes and ideas that you don't pick up on as a kid. And they're like almost more meaningful when you're an adult. It's that sort of thing where a coming of age story is interesting for everyone. Cause when you're a kid, you're like, I want to be there someday. And when you're an adult, you're like, I remember when I made that transition. And if you're making that transition, you're like, this movie is perfect for me. There's some textual things in that movie that are done with set design, which when we talk about Labyrinth, which will definitely happen on this podcast, right? I'll get into it.
What's a bit of time, Brad?
Yeah.
baby steps.
Next two episodes, E.T. and Labyrinth. And Weekend at Bernie's. But yeah, I mean, you know, David Bowie, come on. Jennifer Connelly, come on. Produced by George Lucas, written by Terry Jones of Monty Python, directed by Jim Henson. Puppets, David Bowie songs, entertaining emotional story. It's the best. My first concert ever was David Bowie and Nine Inch Nails playing together. But I was 13. So I was just like, play Labyrinth.
I feel like everything you listed there, I was watching Michael's face as he nodded along. I'm like, are these pluses?
Yeah. He's like, wait, Monty Python was involved?
Negative.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Puppets.
Well, I just, yeah, there is something like, yeah, just so fascinating about, again, kind of returning to the 80s thing and like that a movie could have all of those things that you just listed.
Right.
Is kind of insane. Like that didn't keep happening. Like that is kind of a special thing of a time. And it's like I can imagine how cool it is if all of those things are things that you like to see them like perfectly orchestrated and telling a compelling story. Like that does sound magical, and I'm not like happy that that doesn't work for me. It's just, I'm on the other side of the fence there, but it looks like your territory is great and you're having a great time. So
right. Ryan's territory inside the labyrinth. Yeah.
That and Blade Runner, those are the two places I want to live, is in Blade Runner world or in the labyrinth, or maybe on Hoth. I don't know. We've got to, you know.
Yeah, it's too cold.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's cold. Definitely Blade Runner. I'll live.
No, Endor. Why did I say Hoth? No, I want to live on Endor on the tree houses.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so as far as bingos go, I think Empire is the only one that showed up on all of our lists.
Really?
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah, we I feel like I single-handedly ruined this in a couple different ways. Sorry, guys.
I mean, if I had to pick one person who would not have Last Crusade on your list, it would not be you, Trisha. Like, that was just really surprising. That's not shaming. I didn't expect anybody else to necessarily have it, but I was like, yeah, but Trisha will probably have it.
It really was for a long time, but like, I don't know. My ones after 10 are all like real travesties that I couldn't include them. So like 11 is Aliens. That would have been really close, I think. And then, yeah, I have When Harry Met Sally there. And then I have other good ones that really rule, like Sex, Lies, and Videotape and Das Boot. Oh, wow. I couldn't get to.
Sorry, what was Sex, Lies, and?
Videotape.
And the other, did you say
that? And Das Boot.
And Das Boot. There we go.
Does Brian not know the last
one? That was not the one I heard.
Have you not heard of that movie? The third thing is Videotape.
Sex, Lies, and Das Boot.
Yeah.
Oh, but my God. Anyway. Yeah. My list was not. I was just like, Neverending Story, Blue Velvet, Breakfast Club, Blood Simple, Brazil, The Burbs, Do the Right Thing, Brazil. Dark Crystal, yeah. Bill and Ted, Back to the Future, Ferris Bueller, Weird Science, Pink Floyd's The Wall, Aliens, Die Hard, Raiders. I was just like,
it's
man.
So much.
Nobody had Die Hard.
Trish had Die Hard.
Trish had Die Hard. Did you have Die Hard?
Yeah. Okay. Oh, yeah, I did. Yeah. I had Die Hard.
Okay.
Yeah, but that only showed up once, which was surprising. Back to the Future almost made it. It was on three of us, but not on mine. Brian's
yeah,
list.
It was yeah. one of the. I think Back to the Future is my same as Jurassic Park in the 90s for me, where it was like, I love it dearly and I've loved it since I was a kid, but I just never had that, like, I need to watch this every week relationship with it that, like, a lot of people our age have.
Yeah. I don't think I had it that much either, but I had it enough that it could be in my top 10, but I don't feel like I have the relationship I have, like, that Michael and Trisha have with it potentially. Mm. Yeah. It's an interesting one, yeah, Back to the Future.
Well, and hopefully we'll get to talk about it soon, as that is one of our...
Don't we have a milestone where if
we reach a certain point,
we get to talk about Back to the Future?
Yes, we do indeed. We get to talk about all of the Back to the Futures, and it would be very fun to revisit that. And we also
need
have
more patrons to do
we
that.
We need more patrons. Mm-hmm. We also have a milestone on the way there where we talk about the Bourne films. I actually just watched The Bourne Identity, and I'm like, I have thoughts. I want to talk about these things. So if you want to help us get to that, head over to the Beyond the Screenplay Patreon. There are lots of perks. We have a monthly patron exclusive episode. Oftentimes, you guys get to vote on which movie that is. There's different themes. And so that's lots of fun. There's Discord. And speaking of the Discord, hey, everyone on the Discord, send us your list of top 10 favorite films of the 80s. It's always fun seeing people, and on Twitter too, like sending us their top 10s in the YouTube comments. I think this is a fun exercise to force yourself to do every once in a while. And I really kind of want to revisit some of our, like, go back through the 90s and the aughts and the 10s. Like, mm-hmm. I'm curious if those lists would be same today as they were when we recorded those episodes. But this has been our episode.
Tell us who won. Sorry.
Oh, right.
Thank you.
Tell us who won the game show.
Yeah. Right. That's the most important thing. Tell us who won.
Thanks, yes. Alex.
I want to say a big thank you, of course, to the patrons that make the show possible. Thank you to our producer, Vince Major, and our editors, Donovan Bullen, Caleb Berg, Graham Harther, and Eric Schneider. I'm Michael Tucker. I've been joined today by Trisha Rand, Brian Bittner, and Alex Calleros. Our Twitter handles are in the show notes. Again, send us your top 10 of the 80s or any decade. Why not? Just send us all of your top 10s. I like seeing the different personality traits that these things reveal. Like, are you an alien or an aliens person? That's really all I want to know. And we will see you in the next episode.
Bye, everybody.
We'll be back.
Bye.